Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, 332 years ago, on December 16th, 1689, the English Parliament adopted a Bill of Rights that proclaimed that all English citizens possessed certain, quote, inviolable civil and political rights, unquote, and which also cataloged the conditions for prospective kings or queens for ascending the throne. Exactly a century later, plus 3 years, American revolutionaries followed their successful abolition of king and crown with their own Bill of Rights on December 15, 1791. And 5 days earlier, 157 years afterward, on December 10, 1948, 3 years after the end of history's worst war, the fledgling United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. While the American Bill of Rights are the fundamental laws of the United States, the UN Declaration of Human Rights act more aspirational for humanity in general, but not its reality quite yet. Among the most essential provisions of these two documents are, quote, all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in a spirit of humanhood. And that's UN Article 1. Everyone is entitled to all rights and freedoms without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. And that's UN Declaration of Human Rights, Article 2. No law shall be made respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free expression thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition for a redress of grievances. And that was the U.S. First Amendment to the Bill of Rights. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change religion or belief, either alone or in community with others, and to hold opinions without interference, and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. And that's UN Articles 18 and 19. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. UN Article 3. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search shall not be violated. And that's U.S. Fourth Amendment. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. And that's UN Article 4. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. And that's UN Article 23. No person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury of peers, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against themselves, nor to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And that's the U.S. Fifth Amendment. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. UN Article 5. Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. UN Article 6. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. And that's from the Oregon State Constitution Bill of Rights. Some of you who are listening might notice that these articles and amendments have been somewhat scrambled between the U.S. Bill of Rights and the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And that last provision from the Oregon State Constitution Bill of Rights seems pertinent. And the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is the due process and equal protection glue that binds universal and national human rights together. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the protection of the laws. And Section 5 of Article 14. The Congress shall have the power to enforce appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment has been the force for applying nearly all of the specific guarantees of the first 10 amendments, our beloved Bill of Rights. Former President Donald Trump hit a brick wall with the 14th Amendment when he attempted to disclaim birthright citizenship, despite his threats and bluster of executive privilege. Listeners might also notice that in neither documents, articles, or amendments mentioned is a provision for equal rights between women and men. The U.S. Bill of Rights neglects gender equality, and the closest the UN Human Rights Declaration gets is Article 16, in which both genders of full age, quote unquote, have a right to marry, quote, without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion, unquote, and are entitled to equal rights as to marriage, during marriage, and at its dissolution. This article ignores same-sex marriage, which is at least finally recognized in the USA, but remains bitterly opposed by the deposed president and the disaffected Republican Party, both of which openly despise democracy. An equal rights amendment to the Constitution, which reads quite simply, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex, quote, unquote, has failed at least twice and seems dead before arrival for the indeterminate future, especially while women's constitutional rights to abortion are under mortal assault by the aforementioned Republican democracy oppositionists. This pernicious denial of equal human rights to women, and that their half of the human race is unequal and subordinate to the male half, is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic throughout history, especially when muscle and force have brutally and insensitively held intelligence and sensitivity in thrall, despite every declaration of liberty and justice. The final analysis is that human rights, like everything else, reverberate through humanity's entire history, the ancient yin and yang of either ruthlessly accumulating power and privilege for the few or establishing and extending rights and liberties to all of humanity. And that was something I wrote. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, the Bill of Rights, America's Greatest Afterthought, with a question. Whenever I think of the Constitution, I think of the Bill of Rights, guaranteeing our freedoms of speech, religion, the press, fair trials, states' rights, and more. But the backstory of how the Bill of Rights originated was not so familiar, at least not to me. So it came as a shock to find out that the Bill of Rights was, in fact, a reluctant afterthought, a political ploy by the Federalists, led by Washington, Hamilton, and Madison. According to Professor Carol Hamilton's 2015 book, The Bill of Rights, Madison's Bill of Rights was more a political strategy than a statement of America's most cherished values. That's a quote. Let's examine its historical context. 5 days before the end of the Constitutional Convention, September 12, 1787, George Mason of Virginia proposed that a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution. The delegates, almost to a man, soundly defeated the measure. They were tired. They wanted to go home. The Constitution was already written, and they were probably a bit hungover. The bender that began America, quote unquote, September 17, 1787, involved consumption of 54 bottles of Madeira, Washington's favorite, 60 bottles of claret, 22 bottles of porter, 12 bottles of beer, 8 bottles of cider, and 7 bowls of punch, racking up a bar tab of $17,252 in today's currency for the 55 delegates. As Hamilton later put it in the Federalist, a Declaration of Rights was mere aphorisms, which would sound much better in a treatise of ethics than in a constitution of government. The Federalists did not entirely trust the people and were leery about giving them too many freedoms. Let's not forget that the Constitution was primarily directed toward white male landowners, who considered Negroes three-fifths of a human being. Whatever the reasons, the framers had made a serious mistake, as the omission of a Bill of Rights had united the Anti-Federalists and given them ammunition to oppose a Constitution they already mistrusted. To rectify their grievances, the Anti-Federalists called for a second convention. To prevent a second convention, which would undo everything, and to ensure ratification, the Federalists, led by Hamilton, agreed to add a Bill of Rights, but it would be their Bill of Rights. Written by them, this Bill of Rights would dose out just enough freedoms, quote unquote, to appease the people, cut the Anti-Federalists off from their base while taking credit for the bill themselves, and at the same time preserve the Constitution as they had written it. As Madison had predicted, the Bill of Rights, with little dissent and little discussion, was passed. But then nobody seemed to care about the Bill of Rights one way or another, including the Anti-Federalists and the American people. Even Thomas Jefferson, one of the bill's staunchest defenders, seems to have lost interest. Our beloved Bill of Rights was embedded in a list of laws about fisheries, fishermen, and post office records. Unlike the day-long celebrations of parades and fireworks that commemorated the signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776, and the ratification of the Constitution, July 4, 1788, the passage of the Bill of Rights was met with complete indifference. March 1, 1792, the day the new nation got its long-awaited Bill of Rights, became a day forgotten in American history. How ironic for that now cherished pillar of protection for individual liberties. The March 1, 1792 announcement did not even make the front pages of newspapers, but was buried among advertisements for raw land and cough syrups. It would take the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, and 200 years to make the Bill of Rights finally and truly relevant. In a 1789 letter to James Madison, Noah Webster remarked, "Paper declarations of rights are trifling things and no real security to liberty." How quaint. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. The Bill of Rights, America's greatest afterthought, with a question mark. And now, if anyone should be tried for treason, it is Donald Trump, whose ranting attempt to overthrow democratic governance was based on lies and a baldly despotic intent to undermine the election he lost by a majority vote of American citizens. And he blatantly scorned the peaceful exchange of power that distinguishes democracy from autocracy. Jennifer Rubin calls it for what it is, an insurgent coup plot. And by Jennifer Rubin, Mark Meadows has already established a coup plot. Do we care enough to save the Republic? Multiple pieces of evidence have emerged pointing to a deliberate effort to overthrow our democracy. And it is former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows who is key to piecing them all together. Now we just need to see if the country cares enough to hold all those involved accountable. Start with the two memos from John Eastman, President Donald Trump's lawyer, who sketched out a plan for Vice President Mike Pence to block Joe Biden from assuming the presidency. After making false accusations of election fraud, Eastman suggested Pence could simply refuse to accept Electoral College votes when Congress met on January 6th to certify the results, making Trump the winner, quote unquote, or throwing it to the House, where Republicans on a unit vote, one for each state delegation, might have crowned Trump president. Two additional memos from Trump campaign counsel Jenna Ellis, one on December 31st and one on January 5th, have also surfaced. Politico reports, quote, in the January 5th memo, Ellis argued that key provisions of the Electoral Count Act, limiting Pence's authority to affirm or reject certain electors, were likely unconstitutional. She concluded that Pence, while presiding over lawmakers' counting of electors, should simply halt the process when their alphabetical proceeding reached Arizona. And that was a quote. This, of course, would be patently illegal. Has her state bar been contacted? We also know of Trump's efforts to force the Justice Department to declare the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me, quote unquote, and Republicans in Congress. And we have seen the mind-boggling 38-page PowerPoint plan to conduct a coup, including a declaration of national security emergency that could halt the voting if needed. As bizarre as the document was, even more bizarre are the alleged meetings that Meadows and lawmakers had with the plan's author, none of whom had the common sense and loyalty to report it to the FBI. The House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection, in its document release in advance of the contempt vote for Meadows' failure to appear for his deposition, sets out a list of questions it would have asked Meadows. In doing so, they provided the outline of the coup plot. We would have asked Mr. Meadows about emails about the Electoral Count Act and the prospect of state legislators sending alternate slates of electors to Congress, including a November 7, 2020 email with attachments, the committee writes. We would have asked him about emails reflecting the Trump campaign's effort to challenge election results. Those documents include evidence that Trump's personal lawyer, Rudolph W. Giuliani, quote, was put in charge, unquote, of the effort to reverse the electoral count result, suggesting the undertaking was a private scheme that Trump devised to retain the presidency. The committee also would have asked about emails from Mr. Meadows to leadership at the Department of Justice on December 29th and 30th, 2020, and January 1st, 2021, encouraging investigations of suspected voter fraud, including claims that had been previously rebutted by state and federal investigators and rejected by federal courts. The media has seized on one potential line of questioning regarding a January 5th email from Meadows indicating that the National Guard would be at the U.S. Capitol to protect pro-Trump people, quote unquote. But potentially more damning are, as the committee writes, text messages regarding efforts to encourage Republican legislatures in certain states to send alternate slates of electors to Congress. Even if Trump's team had no part in setting off the violent attack, it was still directing a coup by nonviolent means. The snippets of questions offer a peek into the universe of evidence the January 6th committee is uncovering. The treasure trove of evidence is stunning, leading to several conclusions. First, contrary to complaints that the January 6th committee's investigation is static or not doing enough because they are not conducting open hearings, the committee appears well on the way to detailing indisputable evidence of Trump's role in attempting to override the Constitution. This would expose the jaw-dropping complicity of Republicans who continue to tout the big lie of a stolen election and support Trump as their leader. Second, the fear that any one or even several witnesses will be able to run out the clock is overblown. What the committee already has and can obtain through multiple lines of evidence will likely be sufficient to provide a granular outline of the events leading up to January 6th. Third, one would think that sentient Republicans would understand what is coming and start inching away from Trump. It won't be one witness they have to smear or write off, but rather a mound of evidence, including documents. Fourth, the committee is not compiling a criminal case, which requires evidence that is admissible, not hearsay, and beyond a reasonable doubt. The Justice Department might decide this amounts to a criminal case, but demands that justice officials proceed now are unserious and premature. The committee is acting as the investigative team. Justice Department lawyers will need to see what they have found before making an informed decision on prosecution. Finally, the failure of President Biden, Democrats, and the media to make this the top story looks even more inexcusable in light of the depth of evidence. Given the number of people involved in the coup attempt and how perilously close we came to constitutional disaster, the scheme amounts to the most astounding political story in our lifetimes, or perhaps in history. That those involved in the plot might return to power is unimaginable. That the GOP continues to embrace Trump is shameful. If we cannot collectively recognize that threat to the Republic, then, to Benjamin Franklin's disappointment, we cannot keep it. And that was by Jennifer Rubin. Mark Meadows has already established a coup plot. Do we care enough to save the Republic? She wrote that for the Washington Post. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser-Schalk engineers this program. So now we are on the cusp of winter, which begins Tuesday, which is also a palindromic day, 12 21. The conjunction of millennia has also bequeathed two palindromic years nearly side by side, 1991 and 2002. The next one will be 2112, beyond current lifetimes, and maybe everything else terrestrial, given humanity's willfully wild trajectory. As Alfred Einstein is attributed to have said, the significant problems we have cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Omicron invades Oregon. Sounds like sci-fi. But the plague has swept in on us once again in yet another more virulent variant, putting all of us vaxxers and non-vaxxers in peril. But most especially the overworked and overwhelmed medical women and men trying to save everybody's lives. The no-vaxxers should take the needle for them, if for no other reason.